I'm up on the tight wire.
I'm sitting in the arena, sitting across from my good friend, Daniel Chacon.
And I'm across from my good friend, Benjamin Alida Sainz.
And welcome to another edition of Words on a Wire.
Today we have with us Tim Z. Hernandez, author of The Natural Takeover of Small Things, which is a fantastic new book of poems put out by the Camino del Sol series from the University of Arizona Press. So he's going to be really interesting. He's also a very good friend of mine, another Fresno guy.
He'll also be reading, of course, the poem of the week. Stay tuned for another edition of Words on a Wire.
Tim Z. Hernandez will be with us in just a sec. Tim Z. Hernandez is a poet, novelist, and performance artist whose awards include the 2006 American Book Award, the 2010 Premio Aztlan Prize in Fiction, and the James Duval Fallon Award from the San Francisco Foundation. His poems and stories have appeared in numerous anthologies and journals, and his books have been widely acclaimed, including a spot on NPR's All Things Considered. In 2011, the Poetry Society of America named him one of 16 new American poets. He holds a BA from Naropa University and an MFA from Bennington College and currently calls the Rocky Mountains home. Tim Z, welcome to Words on a Wire.
Thank you. Thank you. It's my pleasure to be with you guys.
Well, congratulations on your new book, The Natural Takeover of Small Things. It's a book of poems. It's a lovely book. And how long has this book been in the process? Because I know your first book, Skin Tax, which I've actually taught in a class and the students loved it and won the American Book Award 2004. So you waited a while. You must have really been working on these poems. Tell us about the process.
Yeah, you know, I have been writing since 2000. Well, the book was published in 2004, Skin Tax, but, you know, I've been shopping them since 2003. So really, since 2003, this is like an accumulation of all the poems I've been writing since 2003. You know, and then it's like I have a big batch of them, and it looks like a giant hamburger, the manuscript, and then by the time it comes out, it's like a tortilla, you know? So really since for the last, you know, almost 10 years.
And to me, I think that's always a good sign that, remember the Orson Welles commercial, we will sell no wine before it's time. You know, I think the same is true with books of poems. You know, you wait and you shape it. And I know with me, sometimes, I get a book out and then I get so eager to get the next book out that I send out a manuscript that's not ready yet. Fortunately, editors are smarter than I am sometimes. And like with Hotel Juarez, I sent it out 3-4 years ago under another title. I'm so glad it wasn't accepted. But yeah. I imagine the process of picking the poems from this for this book must have been difficult if you had so many poems you had written.
Yeah, it was. And you know what? You're absolutely right. That was the situation with this book, is I had sent all these poems out in various manuscripts, throughout the years, throughout the last 9-10 years, to several presses. And they kept rejecting the poems, but just kind of telling me, kind of guiding me in terms of, you know, letting me know, I think, more than I knew at the time, you know, as to what I had there, you know, what I did have and what I didn't have. And that process started to help me weed out a lot of the poems, but also really kind of start to articulate what the book was about and not, you know, yeah, I think I was sending it out prematurely. But anyway.
Oh, so are you glad that happened now when you got wonderful book?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm glad it happened, because in the end, when I did finally submit it as Natural Takeover of Small Things, I really felt like I had a sort of strong, strong point of view there. So, yeah.
Yeah. And you know what I love about this book? It has three sections, and you title each section. The first one is Arms Up in Dead Heat. Mm-hmm. And then part two is San Joaquin Sutra, which is a very long and really pleasurable to read poem. You know, it's several pages long, but you just slide through the language. It's so beautiful. And then part three, Natural Takeover of Small Things. It feels like a book. At what point did you know that this is the shape the book needs to be?
You know what? That actually came about at the very end, right before I finally submitted the manuscript. It was during my time when I was at Bennington College in Vermont, and I was finishing up my MFA there, and I had kept placing San Joaquin Sutra at the end. I knew that that was really kind of the anchor for the whole book, was that poem. I think it summed up everything I was trying to say in that book too, and And I kept placing it at the end, and I tried it at the beginning, and then it wasn't until one of my professors at the time suggested, you know, what if it's the spine of the book? And I went, wow, that's a good, I would never have guessed, I would never have thought that. And so I placed it in the middle, and now suddenly the rest of the book kind of came together and made sense how I would put it together. So
we're talking to Tim Z. Hernandez, whose new book just came out, Natural Takeover of Small Things. It's a book of poems, a lovely book of poems. You, shall we say, entered the publishing world in a sort of unconventional way. Most of us get a master's, an MFA in creative writing, and then we take our thesis and turn it into a book and hope that it gets published. You had your first two books out before you even decided to get an MFA, didn't you?
Yeah. You know, the first one, Skin Tax, the book of poetry, it was at the sort of urging of a mentor, Juan Felipe Herrera, who at the time said, you know, you've been doing the cafe circuit for years now. You should have enough poems for a book.
Sounds like Juan.
Yeah, and he said, unless you're going to continue to read in cafes the rest of your life, what's up? So, anyway, that one won a contest, yeah, in San Francisco, the James Phelan Award, and then and that got published that way, and that was actually before I had even gotten my BA. And from there, I knew I wanted to teach. That was kind of just something I'd always wanted to do. And so then I started to, you know, obviously look at going back to school. You know, I'd been to college before, but just never finished. Mm-hmm. So I went back to school. And again, after the BA, towards the latter part of my BA, when I was still in school there doing the undergrad work, I started to work on stories, started to focus on fiction. And that's what became Breathing in Dust.
Right, which came out in 2010. And that also swept up some awards, didn't it?
Yeah, the Premio Aslan Prize is what it picked up.
Some LA awards, too, I recall it placing in some California Book Awards.
Yeah, it was a finalist for the California Book Award. And that was just exciting to be among the finalists there. You know, because I always felt like it was really a California book, you know?
Yeah. Well, you know, after reading this book of poems, you know, I thought, this is a Fresno poet. You know, I mean, the book is so rooted in the valley. And, you know, and you just add to all those great Fresno writers, all those writers, those poets who have come out of Fresno. I don't know what it is about the soil there, but it seems to grow a lot of good poetry. Who are your Fresno influences, your Fresno poet influences?
In terms of the writing, you know, I didn't really come into, I think, the Fresno school of writers really in my early, like, writing. It was more, I didn't learn about them until, you know, I was already done with my undergrad, really. It's when I started to realize, oh, there's a whole school of Fresno writers here. But I think now looking back, I obviously was drawing from some of them, whether intentionally or not. And one of them was Larry Levis, I think, has probably been really influential on my work. And in fact, even like in Skin Tax, I think that there's like the first line of one of my poems is really a line from a Larry Levis poem. And, you know, it was like something that I just kind of, I think I picked up without realizing it. And then later on, until a friend said, hey, that's Larry Levis. And I said, yeah, that is where I got it from. You're right. It's like, but Larry Levis's work has just been really impactful on me. I mean, I love his work. You know, Juan Felipe Herrera also is one that's, you know, the images that he uses and the way that he uses words as musical notes in many ways is something that's, like, always been intriguing to me. So,
right. Yeah,
writers like that. And then, of course, you know, friends and the history of the valley itself have really influenced my, you know, my work too. So,
I understand that you used to be involved in a teatro group with Juan Felipe Herrera.
Yeah. I'm not from Fresno originally. I'm from one of the smaller towns, actually, Visalia and Dinuba. Those areas is where I'm from.
Right.
That are smaller communities in San Joaquin Valley, about 45 minutes, 50 minutes away from Fresno. And at the time, I was looking for a community to be a part of, you know, an arts community. I was into visual arts. I've been a muralist for a while also, and, you know, a performer and writer. And anyway, that kind of led me to, I met Juan Felipe because I saw a play at Fresno State. I went to see a play, and he was in it. And I met him, and he said to me, you must be a poet. You know, I don't know why. I think I was wearing a beret. Maybe that's why. He said, you must be a poet. And no one had ever called me that. No one had ever pointed at me and said, you're a poet. You know, and I was probably like 20 years old at the time. And I said, okay. And he invited me to read. Even though I wasn't even from Fresno State, I wasn't at that school. I was in a whole other place. He invited me to read with his students. So I went to read with his students in Chinatown there in Fresno. And after that, we kind of hit it off, and I ended up hanging out with the students because, again, I was seeking, you know, that kind of community to be around. And next thing I know, I was in this teatro with them, Teatro Zapata, and we did a lot of just far-out, experimental, avant-garde kind of theater, a lot of physical theater and stuff.
Right.
And I actually went on to get my minor in physical theater because of that. Yeah.
Wow. Yeah, Juan Felipe Herrera is current California Poet Laureate and one of the most really the most generous poets I know when it comes to encouraging younger poets.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, he can tease the poet out of anybody, you know.
And you seem to pass it on. You seem to be very encouraging of upcoming poets.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I try to be, only because, especially poets that come from really sort of rural areas where there's very limited resources, very limited contacts. Like, I know how that felt coming from a small farm community myself, and I know that yearning to be a part of a community, to have my voice heard. And so for me, I feel like whenever I see that, I just recognize, you know, I think I just recognize a sort of something of myself in that, and I say, you know, I gotta do what I can to help out, just as I was helped.
As you know, I'm from Fresno, and one of my best friends was Andres Montoya. We came into poetry really at the same time. We were both involved in politics at Fresno State, and I took a poetry class and convinced him to take it too. So we were in this Peter Everwine's poetry class, and ever since then, we never went back. I mean, we put our politics into our poetry.
Right,
but
right.
His first book, which also won the American Book Award, came out before he got a chance to see it because he died.
Right.
And I know that you've had a relationship with Andres Montoya. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. The first time I actually met Andres was was at the Centro Bellas Artes in Fresno. It's Fresno Chinatown there. I was going to do a reading that was set up by some of the folks up there who ran the place. And when I went there, they introduced me to this kind of big guy named Andres Montoya with long ponytail, you know.
Yeah, and his prison jacket and big boots.
Yeah, exactly, with his glasses on and stuff, and he just has such a sort of a disposition about him that was, you know, I think captivating, you know.
Yeah. Kind
of. And anyways, I read, and afterwards, we just started, we hit it off, basically, at this reading. We started talking a lot, and next thing I know, I learned that he was a professor there at City College, and, you know, I wasn't there in Fresno, living in Fresno at the time, but it was enough reason for me to continue to want to go back to Fresno. And after that, I saw him quite a bit. Once I started doing work with the teatro there at Fresno State, I actually saw him quite a bit. We crossed paths a lot at readings and other functions, and we started talking more. And, you know, one of the things that right before Andres passed away is when we started really kind of connecting. You know, we'd see each other more frequently and talk more frequently. So it was just, I think our relationship was just on the rise, and then he passed away. And one of the things that I frequently remember about Andres telling me was, you know, I think he was always trying to convince me that there was another way to include my politics in the poetry, sort of other than just a sort of place of angst, you know, that maybe from a place of love or something. And
wow.
I remember conversations where he was trying to convince me of that in some way. Like he kept telling me, you know, consider Neruda, you know. You know, that's something I remember him saying, yeah. So, you know, those are my sort of impressions of Andrea. And then when I told him, he said, what are you going to go to school for, Tim? And I told him, you know, for writing, creative writing. He goes, oh, you poor sap.
That sounds like him. In your poem, Adios Fresno, you have an image of Andres Montoya and Omar Salinas standing on a corner, on a street corner in Fresno. Omar Salinas, I don't know if our listeners remember him, but he was really one of the pioneer Fresno Chicano poet. Even though he was from Salinas, he was all over Fresno wearing his Picasso jacket and drunk, bespeckled. He was quite a character, the crazy gypsy. Has he had an influence on your work?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, and I think very much almost in the same kind of way, in the same voice or the similar lineage that Andres was pulling from, I think Omar Salinas was pulling from also.
Oh.
You know, I think Omar was really, I really think he was underrated in terms of, you know, poetry, just in poetry circles.
Absolutely.
You know, really sort of not, we don't hear much about him or anything, but, you know, Omar, I mean, yeah, the crazy gypsy, Omar's voice to me was stark and dramatic. And also at the same time benevolent and sort of tender, you know. And I love that. I love that about his voice. And I would, if you knew him and spoke with him, at least to the degree I did, you know, like I would never have guessed that that's the kind of poetry he would have written, you know.
Right.
But he was a consummate poet. And you know, he would hang around the Tower District there in Fresno, and he would hang out and smoke cigarettes with the young kids, like the teenagers that were in college, you know. And
right.
And they would kind of circle around him and ask him questions about poetry and. He was kind of a mentor, that street mentor in that way, you know?
Yeah, he was quite a character, and he studied with Philip Levine and Peter Everwine. He disappeared far too quickly. His work you don't see around much anymore.
Right.
I remember the first time I heard about him, I was a waiter, or a busboy, actually, at a restaurant, and the waiter was an English major getting his master's degree, and he told me about Omar, and I go, no, never heard of him. So he bought me a book of Omar's and had Omar sign it, and it said, Daniel, if you ever get married, don't look at her left leg, Omar. And I'm thinking, you know, and I asked the waiter who gave it to me, I go, what does that mean? He goes, I don't know. And for years, I wondered what it meant. And this was years before I met Andres Montoya or started writing poetry myself. But when I did meet him, I showed it to Andres. And so Andres and I would wonder all the time what it meant. And in fact, that image showed up in a lot of Andres's poems. If you go into his books, you'll see there's images about don't look at her left leg or something about her left leg. And then finally, years later, I meet Omar at Fresno State, and I ended up becoming pretty good friends with him because he's very generous with young writers.
Right.
But I saw him. He was at a poetry reading. I didn't know him at the time. I was very intimidated. But he was walking across Fresno State campus, and I ran after him. I said, Omar, and I told him years ago you signed blah blah blah. And I go, what did you mean? And he says, it was a joke.
Was a joke.
That's it. I go, oh man, all this time I've been making that line so profound. But I guess that's what we do with poetry anyway.
Yeah, and you know, one of the reasons why I wanted to put Omar into this book, where I felt like, not that I wanted to put him, I just felt like the poem I had written about him years ago fit into this book, is because, you know, there was this sort of real natural quality about Omar, this almost organic sort of quality about Omar, you know, that he was a hardworking poet, but at the same time, he was a natural poet. You know, he just kind of saw the world that way, I felt. And that was something that, you know, when I went to his funeral, and it was just fascinating to me. The same with Andres Montoya, who was buried in Fowler, and Omar's buried in Sanger, and these small little towns, these little farm worker communities, literally in the middle of the fields, in the middle of the orchards. And to me, that was like, wow, it's kind of a, I think Whitman said, you know, I bequeath myself to the earth so I can grow from the grass that I love. And I felt like that sort of quality about it, you know, sort of, to me, I felt like that's what this book is about also. It's about, where's that line between what is man-made, who we are, and what nature is, you know,
and
what takes over what, you know, that kind of quality. So I felt like it just was fitting for this book.
I think he's had influence on a lot of young, upcoming Chicano poets, including Andres Montoya, and a role that, surprisingly, Andres Montoya seemed to have taken over with his first book. So maybe they are kindred spirits in a way. So I really love that image. And do you write longhand, or do you write on a word processor?
You know what? I have to type. My hands have to be clicking to think.
Oh, really?
Yeah. You know what? But it's funny because I've been a journal writer for years, and when I write in my journal, that has to be longhand. I have to have a book open with a pencil or pen and write when I'm writing my journal stuff. But when it comes to writing, like, you know, creative writing, working on, you know, poems or stories, it has to be done on a keyboard.
There's another poem that I found was very moving, Dear Hector. It's about a campesino who's dying in the hospital, and the speaker of the poem comes and visits him. And I love that moment when he remembers, the dying man remembers there's his grocery list in his pocket. Speaker of this poem to pull it out of his pocket and read it. It's a really nice moment. Is this a true moment?
Yeah. And it's pretty much, you know, it's almost like a transcription of the moment. I mean, and even if you look at it, I don't do a lot of sort of image stuff in here than what's kind of there, you know. You know, when my grandfather was dying, he was in the hospital in the town of Visalia there in the San Joaquin Valley. You know, I had been recording him on video and audio for the last 3 years of his life, just because I do that kind of stuff with the family. I record him. Mm-hmm. And when I was there, my grandfather said, I was there in the hospital with him, and he basically started doing exactly as the poem says here. And he was like, where have you been? And, you know, get out your camera. Do you have your camera? I have some things I want to say. And, you know, it was like this progression. On Monday, he was fine and alert and looked like his old self, just sitting there talking with me. Tuesday, he started to slow down. Wednesday, started to slow down. Thursday. So by the very end, he was like, you know, tomorrow I'll sign it. I'm too weak today, kind of. And then tomorrow is the day he died.
Wow. Yeah, I love that last line. Yeah. There seems to be, I'm simplifying and making a very simplistic equation out of a more complex issue, but there seems to be two sides to this issue about, quote, truth in poetry. And one side seems to think that a poem should be true to the facts. And the other side is that poems don't really need to be true to the facts. They need to be true to the language, true to the form, true to the metaphor. Where do you fall?
You know what? Yeah, I see that. And I think I used to feel like that years ago. I probably felt the same way. But I think writing prose has kind of changed some of my perception, my perspective on all that anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Because, you know, writing prose, or at least writing fiction, you know, we're drawing from our memory. You know, there's that whole question of memory. And in fact, I was just asked recently, too, because of my book, Mañana Means Heaven, this novel that's really fiction/nonfiction,
mm-hmm.
You know, they were asking me that same question. I don't know, in terms of my poetry, I really feel like even history, you know, relies on memory. Even history does. So, you know, in every biography, you know, in everything that, in every piece of nonfiction, you'll always find elements of fiction or of,
right.
you know, of leaps. I'll stop calling them fiction and call them leaps, sort of leaps of faith that we take from one subject or one quote-unquote truth to another truth. There are these little gaps, and we have to make leaps. We have to make language leaps between them. And so sometimes they come out as fiction. Sometimes they come out as embellishment. But sometimes, on the other hand, too, you know, the language is what has to sort of be embellished in ways so that it can become believable. You know?
Right.
Otherwise, if we say things as they really are, they'll just be mundane, you know, it's like to some degree. So in terms of the poetry, though, you know, I don't abide by any of those rules. Sometimes they'll be sort of factual, almost what Kerouac called, you know, sketch writing.
Uh-huh.
You know, I'll look at things as they're happening, and I'm sketching down the San Joaquin Valley as I see it. And then other times, I know that, you know, language also has this power of creating myth and history behind it. And so I let myself go there as well. You know, what's to say that tomorrow, Dear Hector and the image of the old Campesino tomorrow isn't just sort of myth, you know?
Right.
And I feel like, you know, that's what we get to do as artists, as writers. You know, we get to look at history, look at fact, and look at myth, and we get to intertwine these things in a way that hopefully sheds a little light on a subject or an idea.
Yeah, that makes sense. In fact, in many ways, poetry is a natural takeover of small things.
Right.
You start with something small, but sometimes you don't know where it's going to go.
You don't know where it's going to go, and you have to sort of allow that to take place. You know, otherwise, you're writing travel brochures.
Exactly. You know, I'm going to come out on the air right now. I've been writing poetry lately. And
nice.
One of the things that I've learned to do is to allow the language sometimes to change the facts.
Yeah.
You know, and the poem seemed to be much better that way. And I'm recalling that quote by Antonin Artaud that Luis J. Rodriguez opens his Always Running book with. It says, "We have the right to lie, but not about the heart of the matter."
And that's great.
You're a fiction writer as well. You mentioned that you have a book coming out, and we'll get you on the show when that comes out. And you also have a book of fiction already published. I'm going to ask you what I think is a hard question, Tim Z. Hernandez. Are you a better fiction writer or a better poet? That's tough, huh?
I should give you the Chacon answer, the same one that you gave me years ago. You said, you know, if I had to choose between one, that's like choosing between children. You know what? I don't know. I guess I don't know if that's for me to say. I know that to me, poetry has always felt more natural than fiction. Fiction, I feel like when I write fiction, I feel like I really got to do work. You know, when I'm writing poetry, I feel like it just comes natural.
Well, that's a good answer that, you know, it's not for me to say. But also your secondary answer seems to be, we've had a lot of writers on this show. We've had a lot of great poets who have also done fiction. And I ask that question a lot, and I really believe that most everybody, 100% of them, had to have answered poetry. I love poetry more.
Yeah,
you know, I don't know. There's something about poetry because I'm a fiction writer. I've been writing fiction since I started writing, and now that I'm writing poetry, I'm not sure I'm ever going to go back to fiction.
Yeah, watch out.
It's like I discovered my first love.
Yeah, you know what it's like? It's like when you go to a hard day of work. To me, like, fiction is like all day working 9 to 5, you know, slinging hammers or whatever. Mm. And then at the end of the day, you go home to a nice cold beer, and that's poetry.
I like that. That's good. That's good. We're talking to Tim Z. Hernandez, author of Natural Takeover of Small Things. One of the things that I wanted to mention, we don't have too much time, but I just wanted to get it in there, is that you're also very active in the community. You're, you know, you do a lot of work out there. And right now you have a project going about a plane crash that happened. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Sure. You know, the plane crash is actually, the project is based on Woody Guthrie's song, Plane Wreck at Los Gatos, the deportee song that everyone knows and loves and been recorded by Bruce Springsteen and Dolly Parton and Bob Dylan. But that actually, it's based on a real, historical tragedy that happened in the town of Kalinga there in San Joaquin Valley, where 28 Mexican national, quote-unquote Mexican nationals, were being deported. Plane came down, killed everyone in it. And the press picked up the story and only ran the names of, like, the pilots and the government official on board, but didn't give the names. You know, they omitted the names of all the deportees. And so Guthrie was, you know, outraged about that and said, you know, we should give them their names, the dignity of their names. And he wrote a, basically wrote a poem about it that later became a song. And so for 65 years, they've gone nameless, these 28 people. We don't know who their names were or anything. And I decided to write a book about it that originally was going to be fiction. It was just going to, I was going to make 28 stories for each, one story for each person. And as I started going on the fiction idea, I started to do research. And just scratching beneath the surface, suddenly all this information started to come at me, and I found a lot of, it was just like hitting like a sort of wellspring of information. And anyway, long story short, I helped them cover the names of the 28 passengers. The book's underway. I'm almost, I should probably be finished with a good draft of it by the end of May. And it's about all of the people who this one tragedy touched directly. So like eyewitnesses, the families of the victims, the musicians, Woody Guthrie, the other gentleman, Martin Hoffman, who made the song. So it's about the people, that folks that this tragedy touched directly. But wow. Also, this is one of those projects that has leapt off the page and now into reality. And so what we're doing now is I'm working with the cemetery where the remains of these people are buried. And for 65 years, they had a, basically a stone marker there without their names. And we're working now, we're raising money to erect a new headstone with all their names on it.
Tim Z, we're out of time, but can you read a poem? We have a segment called Poem of the Week, and when we have a poet on, we'd like them to read a poem from their new book.
Sure, my pleasure. I'm going to read Brown Christ, and that's, I think, the second or third poem in Natural Pig Over Small Things. Mm-hmm. Yesterday I saw God, a brown Christ hovering above an onion field over tilled plains of the San Joaquin. Frayed constellation of denim, ox hide work boot broken at the heel, curved knife gripped in his fingers. Low clouds undulating, hair of broken lemongrass and rodeo lasso, a fragrant beard of perejil. Everything smelled of sulfur and manure, the silos wept, and the snowflakes tumbled tenderly from the day moon, refracting luminous congregations of aspen, with the music of truck dogs, howling over accordions, shimmering manna light. Thank you.
That was Brown Christ from Tim Z. Hernandez's new book of poems, Natural Takeover of Small Things. Tim, thank you for being on Words on a Wire.
Thank you, Danielle. It's my pleasure.
Well, we'd like to thank Tim Z. Hernandez for joining us for this week's edition, and fantastic book of poems. Definitely highly recommend that. And join us next week when we have our special AWP Boston show. Ben and I went to Boston a couple of weeks ago. We took the Words on a Wire microphone. We interviewed a bunch of writers. AWP is a conference of writers and writing programs, and there's about 13,000 writers in the same complex. And oh, man, there were so many writers that you couldn't get into the bars. Remember, we tried to go into the bar at the Sheraton. They said, no more people. There's too many writers here.
We couldn't get into restaurants. We couldn't get in anywhere.
It was just so
packed with
writers. It was
just a waiting line. But anyway, it was a terrific experience, and you're in for a treat hearing the voices of the many, many writers that we ran into at AWP. So stay tuned for that show.
Yeah, it's going to be a good show.
And thank you again for listening to another edition of Words on a Wire.
We'd like to thank our producer, Norma Martinez.
We'd like to thank KTEP for giving us an opportunity to bring writers to you.
Right here on the campus of University of Texas at El Paso. I'm Daniel Chacon.
And I'm Benjamin Alida Sines.
Don't forget, the next book you read
may save your life.
I'm up on the tight wire.